Here we are at UMBC once again with Dr. Freeman Hrabowski. This time we are sitting in his place to talk about his latest book, Holding Fast to Dreams, Empowering Youth from Civil Rights Crusade to STEM Achievement. And it's good to see you, Freeman.
Thank you so much, Mark.
So where to begin? Let's begin here. I like the way you began the book. It's almost as if you'd... Obviously, you plan this because that's how you think, but this trajectory
yes.
from civil rights movement mm-hmm. to the state of, especially young people of color and black folks in education and where we are, to what can be done about it. But because there's a direct connection for you between your experience as a young child mm-hmm. in the Children's Crusade in Alabama and Montgomery, Alabama, and Birmingham, Alabama, and where we are today. I mean, you see this direct lineage of what's been lost and what has to be regained.
That's a powerful way that you say that, Mark, and you're absolutely correct. I wrote the book with help from colleagues based on several lectures that I gave as a result of people asking me one fundamental question. How did I get to where I am in my life today? How did I choose to go into mathematics? How did I choose to focus much of my attention on not just education, but the education of young people in science? And how did I get to be president of UMBC? And then how did UMBC become such a powerhouse in the education of students of all backgrounds and then with certain specialties, such as STEM achievement, among other disciplines? And I found myself thinking about a fundamental truth, and that truth is this. Each of us is a product of our childhood experiences.
Right.
And so I needed to go back to childhood. And for me, that was Birmingham and growing up in the middle of the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s.
But well, there's a couple lessons out of that, and we'll get to that in a moment. But I mean, just to take a step backward for a moment for what mm-hmm. you describe in the book, which is what Birmingham was when you were a young boy, when you were a little boy in the 50s, growing up in black Birmingham.
Mm-hmm.
And that very special, it was a very segregated place, mm-hmm. surrounded by this racial terror outside of
yes.
the city, but it was a very insulated and powerful place at the same time.
Yes. You know, Mark, it's powerful that you are interviewing me because I know that you grew up as a Jewish kid in Baltimore who had an interest in race even as a child. I know that about you, and that you had an understanding and have an understanding of race that many Americans don't have. And so you would appreciate the fact that I could say that Birmingham was a tale of many, many stories. On the one hand, it was a difficult place, a place that could be mean-spirited in some ways. And yet, for me, I could say it was a place that had a great deal of love, that it was, for me, a community in which some of us who were very fortunate to have two parents, two hard-working parents, children who grew up in church and in neighborhoods where everyone was our parent, and quite frankly, neighborhoods in which we were in and out of everybody's houses, and most important, neighborhoods in which everyone believed in us and pushed us to be our best. And so we were in some ways protected. And when we went outside of those neighborhoods, we were shocked to find that we were considered second-class citizens, and we were back and forth. And so that was that very unusual situation of going out of the situation of love into one in which we were seen as being not as good as, and then coming back in and being told you must be twice as good because the world is not fair.
There's so many parts to this, but first of all, you described Birmingham, Alabama as mm-hmm. this place of 11,000 black steel workers in that industry that allowed a middle class to bloom, and,
yes.
and many of them married, many of them educated, but many married to women who worked in the school system.
Yes.
And so there was this
yes.
community that had a very powerful base to it.
Yes, yes. Yes, very much so.
In the face of all the oppression was on the other side.
Oh, yeah.
The insularity of it all on some levels was powerful.
People were buying their homes. And, I mean, this was a neighborhood that had everybody from Condi Rice to the family of Alma Vivian Powell to Angela Davis. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And everybody was at that time thinking about, for the first time, this was in the 60s, the idea of kids going to college. And at the same time, people were thinking about how to get a system of better education for kids. And so when Dr. King came in the 60s, many people were thinking he's going to mess things up for us. The middle class was very concerned that he would shake things up and people might lose their homes. People had mortgages. And so everybody was not necessarily excited about his coming. They were respectful because he was a well-educated man and he came to our church. And we wanted to listen, but most people were really worried that he would make things worse for the middle class. So it was not as simple or as black and white as do what Dr. King says. It was a very complicated situation.
But when Bevel and those guys came in and said that we had to put the children on the front lines for Birmingham and America to see to change segregation.
Right.
And your parents took you to that church and you listened to King.
Yes.
And then that conversation you had with your parents.
Yeah.
Because
it was very interesting. I had not wanted to go, and they had placated me by letting me do the two things I love to do, math and eat.
I love that, math and eating.
Yeah, right? Math and eating, that's exactly right.
And you still love math and eating.
That's exactly right, that's exactly right. And we went home, and all he wanted us to do was to march peacefully to say that we wanted a better education. My parents said, absolutely not. I could not
12, 13, 14-year-old kids, little kids.
That's exactly right, and even younger than that. I was 12, but I had skipped a couple of grades, so I was about to go to the 10th grade, so I was a bit more mature than some kids. But the point is, they said I could not go, and I told my parents they were hypocrites. They had asked me to come and listen. I did. He asked us to do this, and then he said I couldn't do it. They were very upset, told me to go to my room, and because at that time you did not tell your parents they were hypocrites. But by the next morning, they had come in. They had not slept. And they said, if this is what you want to do, we will allow you to do it. It was not, they said, that they didn't trust me. They did not trust the people in the jail, to be fair to me. And they knew that if I marched, I would have to go to jail. Now, I've thought about that many times since then. I would not have allowed my child to go because I would not have trusted the people in jail. So they had great faith. They were religious people. They had great faith that I would be okay. And they allowed me to go. They did. And it was very frightening. And it was a frightening experience being in jail because the people were not kind to us at all. But the experience taught me a number of things. Number one, no time to be a victim. Number two, most important, don't let anyone else define who you are. Number three, that you can be empowered to make a difference in your own life. And number four, the importance of taking action, peaceful action, to say what's important to you. And finally, that action can lead to a difference being made.
There's one word I want to come to in a moment that you use in this book, but let me get to that. There's two things I just want to say quickly before we get to this word.
Mm-hmm.
One is that I just saw the power on your mother in this story when you described you're having an asthma attack. She was worried you were going to die, and you were in the and you were in the hospital waiting room, and they wouldn't wait on you because you were black.
Mm-hmm.
And she waited and waited, was terrified you were going to die, and she stood up in that room and looked at all the white people across the other way and said, "Is there a Christian in the room?"
Yeah,
that was like
it was powerful. She went over. She really did, because she knew that people always talked about believing in God, and she was so worried. I was truly having an attack, a bad attack. She really was, and she was desperate, and she was a very smart woman, and she just believed that somebody would be decent enough to say, we can't let this child die simply because he's black. And the women got the point and insisted that a doctor see me because they were just calmly seeing the doctors and people were just walking by allowing me to suffer while others were calmly seeing doctors. that was the system at that time. And a doctor did. A doctor did see me. And it was very dangerous. It really was. It made the difference. But people had to do those kinds of things all the time. And it did make the point that there are decent people. Even in the midst of such unfairness, there are always decent people of all races. My parents always said that to me. Never assume that you know somebody simply based on the race or the color of somebody's skin.
And the other thing that hit me about this particular opening of the book was that you were friends with Cynthia Wesley.
Yes, yes. One of the girls who was bombed. It was in the church when the bomb occurred. She was my classmate, and that Friday had said to me, "See you Monday." Mm-hmm. And that Sunday, when church, in the midst of church, the minister received a note and said to us that our sister church had just been bombed, and everybody was so upset, and he asked us to pray, and then we had to calmly leave. And it was later that day, we learned that they couldn't find four of the kids, and one of those children, those girls who had been in the bathroom, in the restroom there, had been close to the commode where the bomb was, and they had been just literally blown up. It was just awful. We had nightmares for years, and one of them was Cynthia.
That was very poignant. I think you knew her, but I never knew that story until I saw it in this book. But you learned a lot. I mean, the civil rights movement taught you a lot. Being part of that taught you a lot. And you couple that with when your parents send you north.
Yes.
To go to school for the summer. Summer, right? Do I have that right? Right.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. Yes.
And what you learned from those experiences, and the word I'm going to throw at you that you point out in the book is the word struggle.
Yes. Oh, it's quite a word. It was my first time being in class with white kids, and they sent me there specifically to see what integrated education would be like, and to we in the South tend to think of education in the North, as we would call it in New England, as being stronger, and it was certainly stronger. It was richer. It was more rigorous, and I was taking literature and chemistry and math, and I was 13, but I was much younger than the class. They were much older. This was 11th grade work, and what was significant, this was in Massachusetts, was that it was hard, but I loved it. I absolutely loved it. The problem was that when the teachers would ask questions and I would raise my hand, even when no one else raised his or her hand, the teachers never, not once, would call on me. Kids would not speak to me, and teachers would not call on me. I was absolutely invisible. It was the first time I understood fully understood a book that my parents had had me read, Ralph Ellison's The Invisible Man. And it was an awful feeling to be completely invisible. I was the only black kid in the class, and nobody would speak. Even when I would speak, they would just look right through me.
Here's a connection between that period of time and now that I was thinking about as one of the bridges in this book
for me,
which is that there was something about being stuck in segregation and the awareness of that.
Yeah.
But that period still was full of hope that things could change and you could move ahead.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And that you had to be twice as good as a white kid.
Mm-hmm.
Parents would tell their children.
Right.
And you had to struggle, and you did have to suck it up and be able to stand up to it and keep moving.
Yes.
Somehow, in the process of the end of segregation, but not total integration, and a bunch of kids being left behind completely in poverty,
right?
That sentiment's been lost.
Yes. Well, let's...
Not completely.
No.
But you know what I mean?
No. But you know what I say? We look at Baltimore now, and this is what I see. Because UMBC gets so many very well-prepared students of all races from all over the world, from 150 countries. But we also get students from Baltimore City, from some schools, who are well-prepared. Few American kids will be as well-prepared as students from some other countries now. We know that.
Right.
But there are some, and some from Baltimore City. And this is what I would say. Unlike the 60s, today, we see more larger numbers of college-educated families than ever before. Only 10% of Americans had earned a college degree of any race in the 60s. 11% of whites, 2-3% of blacks. Today, almost 20% of blacks have earned a college degree, and about 37% of whites. Okay, and about 15% of Hispanics. So you have larger numbers and higher percentages of Americans of all races who've earned a college degree. At the same time, we've got the big problem of people of all races who are in that bottom quartile of Americans who are not getting college degrees. And there's the biggest problem that we face, that if you are from the bottom quartile of Americans economically, of that bottom economic quartile, the probability of your getting a college degree is well under 20%, in many cases under 10%. And so, I mean, in terms of inequality in our country for blacks and whites and Hispanics, we got a big challenge. We, all of us, need to be very concerned about that group most specifically. So when talking about Baltimore City or anywhere in our country, in any other city and rural areas, we need to be doing much more to help that population and many other people. And so in the Baltimore area, let's just talk about race for a minute. Yes, we need to be doing much more to help low-income families, to give them support in many ways in terms of jobs and skills and families and safety and all those issues, while working to help children to learn to read and to make sure they're safe and dealing with all the challenges they face as they work to go to school and to get the skills they need so they can go to college one day and succeed. And at the same time, so we've got those issues, but when we look at the broader area, people don't realize it. Other than the Washington area, Baltimore is number two in America in the percentage of African Americans who are upper middle class blacks. People don't realize that. I mean, when I say that to people around the country, they say, Baltimore? But the new study that just came out from Brookings in the last 2 weeks just shocked America when it said, yeah, it's Washington first, and then it's Baltimore. We are ahead of Chicago, Atlanta, New York. So what am I saying? What the study showed was we have done so well in educating a certain population in the Baltimore, in metropolitan Baltimore, that's city and county, all right? At the same time that we've got this issue of needing to do much more for those who are in that bottom quartile. So we've got both. And that's not just Baltimore. That's going to be the issue for any region of America. And so that's what we got the best of times and the worst of times. And that's what we have to face. So when people say, oh, it's not gotten any better since the 60s, that's absolutely not the case. Anybody who was around in the 60s would have to say that could not possibly be the case. We've got more lawyers, more doctors. Who could have imagined the president of UMBC, president of University of Baltimore, the dean of the Maryland Medical School, the dean of the Pharmacy School, until recently the dean of the Maryland Law School. I mean, all the black lawyers, black doc, all these people, Levi Watkins, who just died, you see what I'm saying? You know, all these people, Hopkins doctors, others, I mean, wonderful people who are a cadre of black professionals. Now, have we succeeded? At that level, yes. Is it enough? Absolutely not. So much more to do. But we should be inspired by the progress that has been made to say we can do so much more. And the point of the book is to say, my goodness, if we can go from having 2-3% of blacks with college degree to 20%, what can we do over the next 20 years to double or triple those numbers and to take some of the strategies we've used to talk about what this country must do to support our mayor and others to build, with our superintendent and others, the kind of support for families, for jobs, to deal with the drug issues and the other challenges of safety, to help the families to ensure that children get what they need and that parents get what they need to make sure the kids can move ahead and get the education.
One child grows up to be somebody that just loves to learn and another child grows up to be somebody you just love to burn. Mom loves the both of them. You see, it's in the blood. both kids are good and mom. Blood's thicker than the mud. It's a family affair.
We have to take a very brief break, but don't go away. On the way to break, we're hearing Family Affair by Sly and the Family Stone. Freddie Stone of Sly and the Family Stone, born on this day in 1946. Happy birthday. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And that's Never Felt This Way by Brian McKnight. Here we are at UMBC once again with Dr. Freeman Hrabowski. This time we are sitting in his place to talk about his latest book, Holding Fast to Dreams, Empowering Youth from Civil Rights Crusade to STEM Achievement.
So let's jump ahead.
Yes.
So... because I was thinking about the when you went to University of Illinois, and then but even before that when you went to Hampton,
yes,
you didn't completely keep up with all the students.
Right,
you kept up, but I'm saying right. You learned that you weren't as prepared as the other students.
Right? I didn't get my A was not quite as high as some of the other A's.
Right.
Did you get that? I got my A's.
I got,
but they just my wife Jackie got a higher A than I got. My wife, Jackie was not my girlfriend yet, but I was so impressed because her A in math was higher than my A in math.
But your name didn't come to like 9th or 10th, if I remember.
That's exactly right. That's why I was so impressed. She got the 100. I got a basic 90. Wait a minute, you're absolutely right.
You made me think of the number of kids I've interviewed over the years.
Yes.
The young woman, Kalima Young, who back in 1993 was a part of a group of cohort of kids I interviewed.
Yes.
Who had just graduated Baltimore City Schools. All were black, all were yes. merit scholars.
Yes.
And she told the story about how she was the top student in her class at Walbrook.
Yes.
Top student in French.
Yes.
Went to the University of Maryland College Park.
Yes.
Went to advanced honors French.
Right.
And couldn't keep up, didn't know what was going on.
Oh.
Right? Yeah. I mean, that maybe, and that is like, almost 20 years after you experienced what you experienced.
Sure. Well, see, and here's the difference on two levels. The advantage I had, having had a mother who was a math and English teacher who had sent me to Massachusetts, was that the education I had received had been supplemented by the New England experiences and experiences at Tuskegee and other places. So I could get A's at Hampton. They were not the highest A's. I mean, Jackie, who had gone to really strong schools in Virginia and had Latin and other things, and then those who had gone to really fine prep schools could get even higher A's, but I could do well. What I would say, though, looking at what I've seen at UMBC, is that there are students in the best schools in Baltimore, the strongest schools in the best programs, who've had strong backgrounds. We get students from the strongest programs who will come in who have enough background that with support can compete against kids from all over the world. So I've had students over the past 20 years, we've gotten students here that we've worked with who have now gone on to get MD PhDs from Stanford and Harvard, who are now on the faculty. I've got students who've come out of Western in the past 20 years who are now on the faculties of places like Stanford with MD PhDs, or have gone on and gotten MD PhDs from Duke. You see, so we can do that if they have a certain background from one of the strongest schools in Baltimore. Now, there, make no mistake about it, the best schools in Howard and Montgomery County in the STEM areas will be stronger than even the private schools, than many of the private schools in the Baltimore area, in the sense that those schools will have given students opportunities to work in national agencies in STEM areas while the teachers working with scientists. In that sense, the private schools will have rich backgrounds, and some of the public schools too, but the best schools in the world will be sometimes those schools in Northern Virginia, in Montgomery County, and Howard County, in the sense that teachers and kids are working in national agencies and biotech companies and IT companies, getting hands-on experiences. And that's what's good, which I could not have had in the South
right.
at that time. There is the deal. The best education involves hands-on experiences. The same thing will be true in the arts and humanities when students get opportunities to do things with artists and humanists in the real world. They will have an even better education. And that's what we work to do at UMBC, to get students working at the Smithsonian, for example, or working at the BMA. I mean, when they do it, whether it's in the arts and humanities or whatever area, to the extent that they get real life experience or working with you, I mean, in communications, right, in internships, then they really get to understand in the profession what it's all about, whether it's about the writing part or whatever it is. They are grounded in the work and they see the relationship between what happens in the classroom and what happens in real life. So whether it's in science or humanities, that becomes important, whether it's in high school or in college. And so when I talk about empowering youth, it's not just in STEM, but that is in life's experiences in education. That would be the point I would make, that somehow we need to be thinking about how to build community among students and faculty and teachers to give students opportunity for apprenticeship programs, for understanding how to ask good questions, for giving them a sense of self, and for teaching students not to allow other people to define who they are. Because what my mother was saying about suck it up was that even if people are not kind to you or ignore you, what you learn to do is not to allow those experiences to leave you feeling unimportant. Right. There is the point that I want right. my students to have. Because in life, for all of us, there are times when people can be dismissive. But do you allow the other person's experiences to define who you are? We tell our students at UMBC that each student must come to have that sense of self to be empowered to define self, you see, and purpose. And that's a part of empowering self, of empowering young people.
And I mean, and the way that it's approached made me think of the thing that you say to students when they come in. And when I read this passage, it was made me think of the opposite people say. Mm-hmm. When you say, look at the person to your right, look at the person to your left.
Yes.
Most people are going to say, X number of you will not be graduating.
Yes, yes.
But your response to them is different.
That's
say, look
exactly
to your left,
right.
Look to the right.
We say to students, look at the student to your left, look at the student to your right. Now, when your parents were in school, the dean said one of you will not graduate. We think that's a terrible thing to say to young people. Because if I'm at all insecure, I'm thinking, oh my goodness, he knows me. He knows I'm not going to do well, so I may as well have a good time while I'm here because I'm not going to be here next year anyway. That's a terrible thing. No. We say, look at the student to your left, look at the student to your right. Our goal is to make sure all three of you graduate. And if you don't, we fail, and we don't plan to fail. And so every student, the idea is every student will graduate. And it makes all the difference in the world in terms, again, of the self-fulfilling prophecy that you're here to succeed. We admitted you because you have what it takes to succeed. It is creating a climate that says to the student, you and I are here together. We are here with you to make sure you succeed. And we will help you to succeed. You are empowered. We are empowering you to succeed in the humanities, in the social sciences, in life. And you will do it. And we are here with you, and you will succeed.
So that brings me to this piece in the book that helps. That I really want to keep building this arc. And part of the arc for me here is when you left Coppin, which is where we first met. When
yes.
You were still at Coppin.
Yes.
And you came here to be the assistant associate provost.
What was Vice provost.
Vice provost. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Vice provost. Mm-hmm. And this is where the journey began in some ways. The journey began with meeting Robert Meyerhoff. The journey began with your idea about what you wanted to try to do here that was different, especially for young kids of color, in the sciences, in engineering.
Even before that, with Mike, my beloved and late Michael Hooker, and we talked about the undergraduate experience. And I said, Michael, I'm
the president of UMBC.
He was president of UMBC,
and I
had been the academic vice president at Coppin, and I was very clear. I said, Michael, I am not coming here simply to be the vice provost for one group. I am African American, but I am an academic. I know how to work with students of all races. I'm coming here to look at the undergraduate experience for students of all races. Don't put me in a pigeonhole. Don't put me in a corner. No. I was very clear about that. I will look at issues involving the academic experiences of all students. So that was my job, to look at the undergraduate experience. Now, as time went on, what was very clear was that students were doing the least well in STEM areas. And the students doing the least well among that group were students of color. So we needed to look at that issue. And that's from that, that's where we moved to looking at issues involving minority students. And then I was talking about that issue, that minority students, particularly African Americans, were doing poorly in science. They were coming here to become physicians because people knew that students who came to UMBC were becoming lawyers and some were becoming physicians, but that students who were trying to become physicians were not doing well, which was a problem around the country, that students were not doing well in pre-med courses, and African Americans especially were not doing well. And I had mentioned it in different places, and Bob Meyerhoff came up as a name of somebody who was interested in understanding issues involving black men. And the name was given to me by Bob Embry of the Able Foundation. Bob said, you know, Bob Meyerhoff has a special interest in understanding the challenges of black males. And he says, why don't you go and talk to him? So it was Bob Embry, whom I knew from the Able Foundation, mm-hmm. who suggested that I go and talk to him. And I did, and that's where we began that conversation. But it was Bob Meyerhoff who was visionary. Bob Embry, who has always had an interest in the city and in children in the city. And then Bob Meyerhoff, who said, I'm doing some things involving women at Goucher, my wife's alma mater. He said, but I want to understand why it is that black males seem to, you see them on TV, either about basketball or in sports, he said, or about young black guys with handcuffs. What are we going to do to help young black males to do better? It was visionary that back in the 80s that he was asking those questions, and amazing. You know, and some people around the country said, well, is Bob Meyerhoff black? I said, no, he's Jewish. They said, well, Hrabowski. They're looking at my black face, right? So it was very interesting. So that, and as a result of that, we talked it through and merit these ideas of minorities in science and black males. And we started with young black males the first year. And his wife, Jane Meyerhoff, was very supportive. And we started with that group. And then we added on young women. And now the program is for students of color with an emphasis, though, still talk about black males and in women and then others. All three. We certainly do.
One of the things about this particular period and what happened then is I'm really interested for people to understand what it is that was built.
Yes,
the kind of what the arms were wrapped around these students,
yes,
emotionally but also academically.
Yes, 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 yes.
I mean, because it was a process you learned over the years how to make work.
Yes, yes.
Right.
Yes,
and it's very critical because it's a model that we need to talk about.
Yes, that's exactly it. And here is the model. First, the most important point about the model that we built was that it takes researchers to develop researchers. Just as it takes an expert in communications to develop an expert in communications. Whatever the profession, you think about the apprenticeship model. You need somebody who knows how it's done to bring somebody into the profession.
Right.
And so the good news is faculty here were willing to support bringing young people into the profession. And the idea was, how do you help young people learn how to support each other in studying together, in trusting each other enough, in saying, well, if five of us are working together and four do well on the test and one does not, we all feel bad that we are here to help each other. How do we determine how much work needs to be done to ensure success? How do we define excellence? How do we determine what hard work really means? How do we look at the best in class when looking at strategies, and how do we think about intellectual curiosity? And what does gravitas mean? Mm-hmm. There's the word, the depth of understanding. And most important, how do we evaluate success? And for that program, real success meant students not simply getting A's, but students learning with great enthusiasm the concepts and becoming excited about the work and about the notion of becoming leaders in science and in solving problems and in exciting people about humankind and the challenges of solving problems that would help humankind.
What was the fundamental difference between, as you talk about in the book in some ways here, mm-hmm. between the approach taken at UMBC mm-hmm. and the approach taken, especially in majority white institutions, mm-hmm. as whatever they call it.
Sure, sure.
But you know what I'm saying?
I got it.
That's the key.
Here's the key. We needed to determine the basic level of skills students needed to excel in the foundational courses. Meaning what? If students earn C's in the first level of work, there was no way they were going to go on and go to grad school because one level would build on the next. And so what we decided was if we wanted to find the very best prepared students we could find, what people have tended to do over the years with minorities is to say, we'll just take students in and help them to be the best. We said, no, let's find the best prepared students we could find and see if we could make them better. So it was the approach of W.E.B. Du Bois, who talked about the talented tenth. Most people had begun to look down on that approach because they thought of it as being elitist. My thought was this. We have no problem talking about the best in basketball. But when it came to the intellect, we tended to think it was inappropriate to talk about the best when it came to blacks. We always want to talk about those at the bottom. And I thought that was, quite frankly, racist. I said, we need to find the very best intellects we could find and work to make them better. Because even the best prepared in our race had not been pushed to be the best in the world. We have never had Nobel laureates in science or medicine from the African-American race.
You're determined to see that change.
That's exactly right. That is exactly right. And we needed to get students accustomed to being seen as extraordinarily smart. When we brought the first group of students, young men, across the stage and asked them to say specifically something about an achievement of which they were especially proud, not one of them mentioned an academic achievement. They mentioned everything but academics. It was so noticeable, I had them come back across the stage. I said, now this time mention an academic achievement. And I'll never forget the young man who was to be the valedictorian from Baltimore Polytechnic Institute, said very quietly and in a very embarrassed way, I've never earned a B in a course in my life. And he almost cried. He was so embarrassed to tell the audience that. He had all A's. And he was ashamed to tell the audience. And I stopped him. And I said, could you say that with enthusiasm for me, please? And I had him say it three times. And then I had the audience give him a standing ovation. And it was a pivotal moment. Because what I was saying was, how dare you not be proud to have earned all A's coming out of the inner city of Baltimore as the next valedictorian of Poly. And it was a pivotal moment for me to realize that these children were not proud to be the best academically.
You know, and it says to me part of it, early in the book you said this, and I was thinking about this as I was trying to tie the threads together for myself, that you start the book off talking about two of your heroes as a child, mm-hmm. W.E.B. Du Bois mm-hmm. and Booker T. Washington.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And we always want to see them as opposite, antithetical to one another. Mm-hmm. La Fontaine Oliver, who used to be general manager of WEAA, mm-hmm. now is going to Florida to run a large classical station, but he had on his, behind him, we had this conversation, he had these two little dolls, he made out of cloth dolls. One was Booker T. on this side, and was W.E.B. on this side. And he said, I have to have them on both shoulders so they keep talking to me in different ears. Right?
So I like that.
Right? And so he lost his WB Du Bois doll. So I found one on Atlanta. I sent it to him. So he wouldn't be lost without the other one. But that made me think of what you wrote in the book here, and that the combination of those philosophies, I want to wrestle with for a moment, about how that's applicable to what you end the book with in terms of where we can go.
Yes, yes. You know, I think people misunderstand Booker Washington. Booker Washington was very appreciative of the liberal arts experience, more than people realize, and actually funded it and gave support to places like Fisk and Atlanta University. Sent his daughter on to a liberal education. He understood the importance of the practical side, too. And if you look at what the American Association of Colleges and Universities will tell you today, they will say that you shouldn't think that a liberal education and talking about getting a job, that those two things have to not be together somehow. You can talk about both. When you talk about what is the value of a liberal education, it teaches you to think well, to be able to write well, to speak well. These are exactly the skills you need to get a good job. People want to know that you can speak and write and think and work with other people. So you don't have to think, one doesn't have to think that because you're broadly educated, you're not ready to have a good job. You know, they go together. They really do. And so when I think about those two people, they both were about excellence in many ways. They really were. So there's been a reinterpretation of Booker Washington in recent years. But more important to me, we need to be teaching children about mindset. So rather than about so much smart. It's not, when I think about smart, I'm really not talking about that you're born this way or that way. I'm thinking about the word we use here, which is grit, a willingness to work really hard.
It's connected to the word struggle you start the book off
with. That's exactly right. It's embracing the struggle.
Right.
It is the notion of resilience. It is that we sometimes learn more from failure than we do from simply winning all the time and always being on top. In life and in coursework and in problem solving.
It's not real.
It's not real. we don't always make A's in life. Nobody does. And that the people who are most successful are those who learn how to adjust when things don't go their way. And so what I'm always saying to students, what we talk about here really is, how do we learn to solve problems? Whether about the problems of Baltimore or how we go about studying T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland. You see, it is about struggling with things we don't understand. It really is. And achievement comes when we learn how to look at the challenges we face from different angles and how to work through those issues with different people, how to ask good questions, how to take the time to breathe deeply and keep reflecting on the problems. I started understanding that in solving math problems as a child, in struggling during the civil rights period, in trying to understand what will it take for people of different races to learn more about each other? What will it take for us to move people out of poverty? I think about it now as I think about how we narrow this gap in inequality, different types, and all the different gaps that we have in our society. I struggled with it as we looked at the cover of the book, when the publishers and I had a disagreement about what we should have on the cover. At first, people were talking about having all blacks on the cover. I said, no, that was not the dream of Dr. King, and it certainly is not my dream. I wanted people from different races on the cover, because the dream has always been that people from different races would learn to dream and work together. That cover is controversial on purpose. That cover looks colorful, but that's the HIV on the cover. That is HIV. The HIV that we study in the biochemistry labs on this cover. That cover has one of my wonderful faculty members, a white guy who's a Howard Hughes investigator. Mike Summers is one of the most productive faculty members in teaching and producing African-Americans who go on to get PhDs in biochemistry in the country. It's got one of the Miles scholars, a young black man. And then it's got one of my Korean immigrants, a young woman who studies biochemistry. They're all looking at that RNA genome as part of the structure that he's determined there. And they are studying that structure because they're helping to solve that piece of the RNA genome. And the idea is this. Here are people from different races, looking at a problem that humankind faces, using their skills to help humankind with one of the fundamental challenges we face as the human race. And the significance is they are empowered as scientists to be humanists. What could be more powerful than that?
I think that's how it fits together.
That's exactly right.
I love this book a lot. I had so much fun with this. I could stay another 2 hours and bring out many more things. Maybe we'll do this another day. Freeman, thank you so much for allowing us into your academic home here to join you and talk.
Thanks for asking such good questions with such deep understanding.
Remember when you were young? You shone like the sun.
We have to take a very short break. And on our way to break, you're hearing Shine On, You Crazy Diamond by Pink Floyd, recorded on this day in 1975.
Like black holes in the sky.